So welcome to this so early in the morning for our course on program optimization. So last time we found that it is that we have methods of doing filling slots in long instruction words if we have a basic block. And we also kind of succeeded in extending these methods to acyclic code. And then we wanted to go for loops. And one possibility of so loops, if they have a small, very small body, then our method will not be very effective. We won't be able to extract a reasonably large amount of parallelism in a small block. So therefore one might want to, so there then we came up with two ideas. The first one we have already elaborated. This was kind of doing a loop unrolling. That means we extended the loop body by twice or three times or any constant factor. And then we had some extra means to possibly removing the intermediate branching and intermediate increments of loop iterators, and that was not so bad a method. There was another a second idea which we then started to think about, and this was can be visualized by this kind of example. Assume that we have two loops, one which are executed in a row, and they look quite similar. So here, for example, and the similarity is identified that the iteration scheme is the same. And then we kind of came up with the idea: why not put fuse these loops into one, and that means that the bodies kind of are combined. Now there is kind of a little bit of a problem, because here in this particular case, so the one problem is that we have here these variables R and S which are used twice. Now this can be accounted for by a simple trick, for example, so in this particular case this would not cause a problem, but in general we might, without doing strong analysis, we might simply say, okay, we put it in something like a single assignment format, static single assignment format, and that means these variables R and S, and in the two loops will be distinct. Yeah, so in that sense, there's no problem with R and S anymore, but there is a potential problem with C. So the C, okay, so it's written, it's read twice, so that is no problem. The problem is that in the second loop it is also written to. And if we kind of fuse the bodies, then this means that there is a write to the C, and afterwards there's still a read to the C, namely for the higher iterations. And so we must make sure that all reads which originate from the first loop will get the old value, and all reads in the second loop will also get all the reads will get the right values. So that is what we have to enforce. So here is our analysis which we have to come up with. So the first thing, once again, in order to fuse the two loops, the iteration schemes must coincide, and the two loops access That we could, one possibility is they, we kind of make sure that they access different data and they are completely independent, and then we can easily interchange them, or access different is even too strong. We could say the second they write only to data which is not read by the other one, so that we that we could that would kind of allow us easily to fuse, but that is not the case in this particular example, because here C is written to in the second loop and it is read in the first. So we have to kind of we have to give up the global global kind of conflict relation, saying that the same data structure is read and written to, but have to take into account the individual entries in the data structures. So that is, we have to provide an analysis of accesses to the same array and see whether there's a conflict there or not. So here, so first we assume that these blocks A, B, C are all distinct. So I may kind of point out that in, I guess, in Fortran or what, which is kind of an array processing language, there you could have also aliases between arrays, and I guess so that you this distinctness of arrays is not necessarily given there. But here in our case, so we assume that we know that A, B, C are distinct, and that is perhaps the most important case. And then we have these things, and now we want to know whether we can put one these loops one after the other. Yeah, and you see here now, why is R and S not a problem here to use it twice? Because in some sense here, in that here is, these are the uses of these definitions. And afterwards, R and S is dead here. So if we put it one in another, here's another definition of R and S, and here use of exactly these definitions, and afterwards it is dead. So in that sense, we can reuse R and S here, so no problem is caused by these variables R and S by putting it one aside the other. The critical point is that C is written to here. And so what can we do? So we could try to identify a conflict and write conditions to these conflicts, and then see whether such a conflict may occur. So what constitutes a conflict? So a conflict, this is this I thing, this unknown I, which we want to find out whether such an I may exist. So a conflict is if at this conflict position, the first loop, if this conflict position is before, is an iteration, so is an iteration I, which is before a read of the first loop, so it is less than X, and it is where the second loop may write, so it is a write of the second loop. Yeah, so this means that it is a write of the second loop. It is between 0 and x minus 1, and it is a write of the of the second loop, and it is before the x. And now the reading is at position x. The writing in this case is also at position now let's see. I wonder. Yeah. So the writing at this in this iteration I, where is a write and x write occur? An x write occurs there. Now you see. Oops. Sorry. A write occurs here. In this, if we are in iteration I, then the write occurs only in this at this index I. So therefore, this comes, this results in this thing. So if we are in an earlier iteration, this I is an earlier iteration than the iteration X. If there's a write, which index is written to, and it is the index I. So this is this statement. So we speak about in iterations. I less than x minus 1, and the read is in the iteration x. The read goes to the index x in this particular case, and then now we want to know, is this read position equal to the write position for one of these iterations I? Yeah. So we search whether there is a solution. Whether we can find an I so that all these constraints here are satisfied. Now you see here, now our trained I notices that these constraints here indicate that I equals X. So I equals X. And these constraints indicate that I is less than X. And so this has no solution. There is no I less than X, which is equal to X. So this gives a contradiction. So that means there is no iteration where the before the... so that an entry of C after fusion... an entry of C in the first iteration is red, which erroneously has been written to by the second iteration. Yeah. So in general, the scheme would look like as follows: if we have here the these. Sorry. So. We indicate that there is I should have this highlighting something. So here this gives me the S is the axis of the second so in this case of the second loop. It has loop bounds, and it's loop bound before the current iteration. Then this is the access of the read access of the first loop. This is the write index expression for the write of the second loop. And you ask, is it possible that these two coincide? And so. And all these expressions, S, T1, T2, and so on, these are expressions which are which depend on the indices, the iteration indices of the loop, and so they Now, in general, if you have any such kind of equation system, and there could be, so it's over the integers, and you could multiply, you could do anything, so then you have a kind of arbitrary arithmetic expressions here, and then we are essentially doomed. But typical applications, say from numerics, where you have a lot of, which is one of the key applications where large arrays and iterations over arrays are used, and in these the index expressions typically are linear expressions. So therefore, a lot of effort has gone, and it makes sense to have dedicated methods which deal with loops where the it is so with iterations over arrays where the index expressions are linear. And in this particular case, this set of equations and inequations is a set of linear inequations. And it can be a little bit simplified. So here this y1 and y2 corresponding to the read and write this x read and this x write, so they, which are equated here to ask whether there's a conflict. So they are equated here, and these are the only, if you like, and here in these the x y1 and y2 occur on the right hand side. So you can equate instead the s1 and the s2, and here you have. This expression S, and then you have, so this is that one, you have this S1 minus S2, and otherwise here you have two further inequations, or the kind of side conditions, and these side conditions you could kind of put into this, if you like, canonical form, so that you always have zero on one hand side and a linear expression on the other hand side. And now clearly, so here it is only two such inequalities because this array C was only accessed once. If it is accessed multiple times, you could have multiple within one iteration. You could have multiple such inequalities. But once again, in general, from a technical point of view, we have a set of inequalities of this particular form. And now the question, our question, and it depends on the sum integer variables I. Maybe if you have nested iterations, then it could be that it is not only depends on I, but also on some kind of J. So you have multiple such integer variables inside it, and you want to. The question is, does it have a solution? So how can we decide such? Is there an algorithmic means to decide such questions? So let us check now. In our little example, it boils down this x read and the x write, which is corresponding to this y, has been eliminated, giving us this equality, and then we have these two inequalities. And these two inequalities give us, so this I is equal to C, so to this I is equal to X, so therefore we have 0 is less or, now let me see, so therefore we can remove here this I. We can use the equality to remove the variable I in the inequalities down there, and this gives us 0 less or equal to x and 0 less or equal to minus 1, and that is definitely a contradiction. So here we see it in very quickly, and there's one point that actually we are interested in integer solutions, because indices take integer values, but often it is easier to deal with these inequalities if you have rationals, if you compute over rationals. And over rationals, well, the question is, now integers is a subset of rationals, so can prove that such a system of inequations has no solutions over the rationals, then you can be sure that it has also no solution over the integers, and therefore there will be no conflict. So now the question is, once again, the question is, how can we deal with such inequalities? And now let us briefly review a few simple cases where things can be effectively and can be solved very fast, and then we may go for the general case also. So let us look first for the one variable case. So we have arbitrarily many inequalities. So you can think of that you use the equality to remove. If you have two variables, you may use the equality, or if you have several equalities, to remove some of the variables, and then only perhaps one variable is left with inequalities. So that would be this would be the case in our application, because we had the equality between x and I, and so we could remove the I, and then there's a bunch of inequalities only in the x. And then the question is, what can we deal with that? And the answer is yes. And here's the systematic way how to deal with it. So you collect all the inequalities where x occurs positive. So what does it mean where x occurs positive? Here is an example where x occurs positive. So this means, so we have brought the inequality into the shape 0 is less or equal to something, and then you look at the factor, at the scaling factor in front of the x. And you, here in this case, it is 5, which is definitely positive. And thinking that you can put that here onto this onto the left hand side, then you find that something is less or equal to a positive multiple of x, and therefore you get a lower bound of x. Okay, so positive occurrences of inequalities with positive occurrences of x give lower bounds, and you may collect all of these lower bounds. Now, if you have all of these lower bounds, then you can kind of take the maximum of these lower bounds. This gives you kind of the best lower bound, and then you have the minimal value for the x. And the same you can do for the case that x occurs negative. Now, negative occurrence means that obtain upper bounds. Again, let us see at one example. So these are things, now I have written it as if you have to learn it by heart, but clearly you just look at the inequality, and then you see what's the case. Okay, it's negative. So if you now try to isolate, to kind of set free the x and put everything else on the other side, then here you have to kind of put that here. Then you have 7x is less or equal to 13. Then you divide by 7. And dividing by a positive number does not change the kind of direction of the inequality. And therefore you get that x is less or equal than 13 divided by 7. So you obtain an upper bound. Okay? And so you can do you take all the negative occurrences, you get a lot of upper bounds, you take the greatest lower bound of these, And then you get kind of the most restrictive upper bound. You have the most restrictive lower bound, and this gives you an interval. And now, you look at the interval, and if the interval contains an integer number, then you have a solution, and if it doesn't contain an integer, then you have no solution. So here in this case, you have this interval. Let us write it down. So it is 1/5 and 13/70. And you see the lower bound is less than 1 and the upper bound is greater than 1. And so you could think of also you round up the lower bound and you round down the upper bound, and then you get an integer interval which is perhaps empty. In this case it's not empty, it consists of the single element 1. Okay? So that's how you do it. So here in this particular case, you obtain an integer solution for these two, which would then provide a conflict, and that would mean that the fusion would not be possible. And there is another thing, so I have not talked about that, but when we put up the inequalities, I only considered the excesses, but one would also have to take into account extra constraints for the I, indicating that we are inside the loop bounds. So you have loop the loop goes from 0 to n. The 0 we have taken into account because the excess to I should be between 0 and x minus 1. But the upper bound we also have to take into account, and that was, I don't know, n minus 1 or something. So this is an extra constraint, but which we simply can express by our inequalities here as well. So that is, So every integer, once again, every integer solution, and that is every integer in the interval, would provide a conflict. So our simple method here of collecting the upper bounds, collecting the lower bounds, was sufficient to decide the question. How general is this solution? So one variable is not so impressive. We had these equalities. Every equality allows us to remove one variable. So it could be the case that this helps us to deal with two variables, and that's that may maybe not so bad already. But clearly, it could be that there are more variables, and in particular, if you have more. If you have non-trivial code, you have nested loops. So it's not so so uncommon to have nested loops, in particular if you have multi-dimensional arrays. So therefore, we cannot stop here. So in general, if you have a set of equalities and inequalities over the integers, then this is a known problem, and you already have guessed it, and probably you all know about it. And this problem is called integer linear programming, or sometimes it's also kind of it's also called ISAT, because it's the question of it is integer linear programming is an optimization problem where you try to find the best solution to. You have besides such constraints, you have a gain function or something which you want to optimize. But here we are only interested, is there a solution? So it's about the feasibility, they call it, the optimization guys call it feasibility of a set of constraints, and that is sometimes also simply, I may write it down, ISAT. Integer satisfiability. Linear integer satisfiability, if you like. And so in this integer satisfiability, It is linear, what we would think linear, everything which is linear is decidable, and this is perhaps true, but it might be difficult, and that is there is one famous problem for this integer linear programming thing, which is results to one of the famous, most famous NP-complete problems. You know which one? It's the knapsack problem, and that's a very, in some sense, and even the most trivial of these things. You have one linear constraint. You just the coefficients are zero or one, and zero. No, the solutions which you look for are zero or one, and you ask. You have a bunch of things of a certain size, and you want to know. So the sizes correspond to the. So I make up a new page and just write down the knapsack. So you have. These are the sizes of the bricks which you want to put into your knapsack, and the xi's take values between 0 and 1, and you sum them up from I equals 1, say, to n, and you want to know, is all that always less or equal to a given bound b, and that's, and you want to I guess you want to know, what is the best, what is the maximal amount which you can put into your knapsack, and these xi are greater or equal to 0, and the xi are also less or equal to 1. So this is all linear, and still it is a difficult problem, and because you kind of essentially, no better method is known as kind of try or guess a subset of the AI which fills the knapsack in an optimal way. So in that sense, the problem is not so is here even more general, because you have more general forms of constraints, and you have many of them, and you have an arbitrary cost function. So, but even already, if you don't have a cost function, just checking whether such a set of equalities and inequalities has a solution is also NP-complete. In the old days, one would kind of get depressed and would say, so now we are doomed and can do nothing anymore. But nowadays, quite efficient solvers for integer linear programming are around. And mathematicians and theoretical and algorithm, theoretical computer scientists and algorithm guys have put a lot of effort to come up with smart methods to solve these kind of problems. And it is really impressive how large systems can now be tackled. And here in our application, our systems, as I may recall, the number of variables in our systems are small. There could be many constraints and many means, perhaps 10, 20 or something, but the number of variables is small. And so that is, in that sense, it is NP-complete, yes, but somehow we do not need to care about it. Now let us kind of since now we have this integer linear programming thing, who of you have ever thought about that or have encountered that in some other lecture? Have you encountered integer linear programming? So it makes sense to, because it's a general technique, it's something which you can consider as a takeaway from that lecture, even if in your future work life you never will write an optimizing compiler, you still might encounter the problem of solving ILP problems. So in that sense, this is a key issue, and it's a little bit sad that linear programming and integer linear programming do not play a very prominent role in computer scientist curricula. So let us see what we can do about it. So the first thing is, it is a specific instance of a more general logic which is called Pressburger arithmetic. This is a class of problems which in the most general form we look at in the end. We will do not very much with it, but just again to your information. And that is all kind of linear problems. So you have arithmetic, but no multiplication. Or you have only that is not completely true. You might have multiplication, but only multiplication with constants. So that's it. And so somehow these are the problems. These are, one would consider these are simple problems, and one would might think that these could be solved somehow. But it turns out that the question is now if they can be, and it is true they can be solved, but the question is how efficient can we do it? What kind of algorithms are around? So now let us, before we go to inequalities, let us see even, now we may say, okay, so let's just now, just to get as a warm up, think about linear equalities. Now linear equalities, you might say, okay, so what's the point? So that is, I guess you all and probably also I had kind of an algebra course or linear algebra course. And the first thing was to solve these linear equations. Now, what is here the point? The point is that we are interested in integer solutions. And this makes it a different story, because the key method to solving, or one key idea in solving these systems, was to divide. So the first step would be, for example, or one possibility would be, you divide by two the first equation, and then you kind of have the x, the coefficients are the same for the x. Yeah. Now we have no possibility to divide by two, because here is a three three has not two as a divider, divisor. So we cannot divide. So what can we do? So the only thing what we can do is multiply. So that is the only thing what we can do is what we can do here in this particular case, we see that so we can multiply in that sense, because that the x is we can multiply the second equality by two, and then we have two x everywhere. So by that we kind of make it larger, the coefficient, and not smaller. And if we make it larger, that means there is the danger that we miss opportunities for later subtraction. So here, but here in that case we could remove the x by multiplying the second equation with two and then subtracting. And so there is a hope, have hope that something is possible here. So now here once again, so if you have such a system of equations, so whether there is a solution or whether there is no solution of a Q, that we know how to deal with. Now the quest. So in that sense, and how expensive is it to solve a system of equations over the rationals? So these linear algebra routines, how expensive are they? Is it obvious? Is all there obvious, or is it not completely obvious? So the first thing is clearly succeed with a cubic number of arithmetic operations, but that does not give you the complexity, because numbers can grow, because you kind of have to compute with either this, or there are two possibilities: either you compute with floatings, with floats, then you encounter all these problems with precision, because then you might end up with near zero values, and then the error margin might kind of get in conflict with, so you can get arbitrarily far from a solution just because of, think of that, if you made an error and something gets a value which is almost zero, and you use that as a pivot element to kind of to divide by it, and dividing by something which is almost zero is almost it's a very large number, and by that you kind of destroy all precision, and you get more or less stupid results. So therefore, if you compute with floating points, you may get arbitrarily stupid results, and if you compute with precise numbers, so that means with rational numbers, so these are kind of represented by two pairs of integers, then it might happen that you have to consider very large integer numbers. And that is again a problem, because this may kill your polynomial time algorithm. So what I want to say by that is that even that solving systems of equations, although we seem to know it, in fact we do not know it so well how to deal with it. And I guess if one has to attend Thomas Huxley's lectures to get an impression what kind of interesting ideas there are around to deal with solving systems of equations, large systems of equations over some numbers, which are floating points and typically not exact not exact numbers. So this approximately solving equations, that is what I want to say, is still in. It is not so completely trivial, and it's a numerically interesting problem. Now let's go over the integers. So over the natural numbers, then we will kind of come into an area where we are very close to the knapsack problem. So there, I guess we end up in NP completeness. But let us therefore wonder, can we do something here in that area? And is it closer to the rational case, or is it closer to the natural numbers case? And the answer it is in fact close to the rational case. And that means there is a polynomial time algorithm, and that's a surprising thing to solve that over the integers, up to sizes of numbers. So you have to work a little bit to get to, and people have invested quite of a numerical effort to provide integer solutions to such systems where the integers are not so large. Okay, so now let us consider our super duper equation system again. So here we find that there is over the answers are now the question is how to what has to be computed here. So over the rationals this will have a solution, over the integers it will have no solution, and over the naturals also, and for the complexity it turns, so ignoring sizes of numbers, one obtains polynomial complexity for the rationals and the integers, and for the natural numbers everything is NP hard. Now let's see how we can solve it for the integers. So I said we have no multiplication, and that's the point. And so the first thing is we start with simple problems. So always so one equality problem is might be the most simple thing. And now where we have coefficients which are non-zero to the left, and there's a b to the right, and we wonder, does that this kind of single equation has a solution? So over the rational numbers, this always has a solution. Why? You can take the x2 to xk to zero, put them to zero, and you have only one variable to the left. You divide by a1, and then you have a value for the x1, and then everything is, you have a solution. So no problem. But here, over the integers, it is not so. For over the integers, instead, you have a solution only if the GCD, the greatest common divisor of the coefficients to the left, divide the B. Because that is kind of the point. Whatever you multiples you put to the x1 to xk, you always get a multiple of the GCD. So therefore, if the result of the left the summation to the left gives b, it must be a multiple of the GCD. And on the other hand, it turns out that every multiple of the GCD can be obtained as such a linear combination. And that is the second insight. And by that, for that, you get this if and only if. So since we can compute now, the next question is, can we compute GCDs? And the answer is yes, we can. So this is this Euclidean algorithm, this famous one, and that is the method of choice here. And in fact, it turns out that this that when we solve now general systems of integer equations, the GCD will take the role of division. And that is kind of the workhorse, if you like, and the secret trick how integer systems of equations can be attacked. So now let's just, in order to think, to get a little bit familiar with this GCD trick, as an example, we may look at that thing here. Then we see that the greatest common divisor of the coefficients to the left is 5, and 5 does not divide 18, so therefore 18, there's no solution. Yeah. Now, and then the other thing is, we may kind of, another possibility, then there's this kind of trick, which we kind of may play. So that is, we do not kind of remove one equation, but kind of just add some multiple of one equation to the other one. So here, if we have that one, we kind of may add a multiple of this one to that. And by adding multiples of, and that gives us a system which has exactly the same set of solutions, and it might be simpler. And it has the same set of solutions, because now we could revert that also by, and therefore it is it's kind of a invertible transformation, and therefore it does not change the system, the solution set. So here, and by doing, and in fact we can go so that's it. And so then there is another thing which we can do. These are the row operations, if you like. And the second thing is we can also do column operations. Now, column operations, that is, we may add multiples of columns to another column. And that is also one of these invertible transformations, but it kind of transforms the solution set. So therefore, we have to keep track of this kind of transformation, and that we could do by maintaining such an extra transformation matrix where we kind of execute the same operations. And so then that would be kind of the inverse of the transformation. So this allows us to recover the solution of the original system from a solution of the transformed system. So here in this particular case, we could use here this column and add it twice to that column. And that we would do here, the second column. So this column is added twice to this column, and that means that the 2 arrives here. And again, we have succeeded in simplifying the system, a little bit. And yeah, you see here this twice this minus one, so minus two has been added to the five, giving three here. And now and yeah. And these two kind of operations we can then repeatedly apply until we have put the system into a triangular form. And triangular form means that we have one equation where there is only one variable left, and then this yeah, here in this case it has no solution, so therefore we there nothing can be so the system has no solution. But assuming, for example, yeah, if we have such a triangular form, and maybe here this 18 is not 18 but 15, then we would get a value for the y, then we would kind of be able to substitute the y away, and then we get, since it's a triangular form, only one variable, so there's one left for the x, and so on. And so by that, we successively may remove variables and read off a particular solution. So this means by that we obtain a special solution from such a triangular system. And then if we have a homogeneous triangular system, then there also we can get a basis for the set of all solutions, and by that we can determine all solutions of that system. And from that, from these solutions, we can recover the solutions of the original system by multiplying this triangular matrix, which we had, which we additionally have kind of accumulated. So, thinking of this particular system, so here is this transformation matrix which we have. So here we obtain that y has the value 3. And then we get that here, inserting 3, we get that x might be what? Ah, yes, if we insert 3, and then if we have 3 here, and put this minus 3 to the other side, we obtain that x equals 6. And the variable set does not no longer occur, so therefore we can put it set to 0, for example. This gives us one special solution of the system, of the transformed system, which is this one. And then the homogeneous, now if we kind of look at the homogeneous system, so how does the homogeneous system look like? So for the homogeneous system we would put zeros here and check what possible solutions we could have here. Well, then this putting zeros to the left means that y should be zero and x also should be zero, because otherwise you cannot obtain the zeros. But the variables which do not occur, in this case the set, these are the variables which kind of span the set of solutions of the transformed system. So here the only variable which does not occur is the variable set. So therefore we have this single vector which spans all of whose multiples we may add to the special vector to get all solutions. So that's the point. Now these two vectors have now to be transformed by this matrix, and that gives us okay, so now one has to do a little bit of calculation, I guess. This vector is invariant by this transformation, if I don't make a mistake here. And this vector, gives, it is also invariant. So in that sense, we have already the solutions, characterization of all solutions. Yeah. So that in that sense, we managed by these kind of tricks, just by using multiplication and subtraction and addition, to solve these systems, and essentially, and that essentially works for all such systems. Now, it coming back to the natural numbers, then I said this is an NP-complete problem, and people have even noticed that this problem is already difficult, not if you have thousands of variables, but you can write down certain instances of such equation systems with just three variables per per equation, and you can that suffices to encode NP-complete problems. So, but that kind of now, if when people have come up with a three variables per equality, that this might cause problems, one immediately might start wondering what happens if you have only two variables per equality. And there are at least certain polynomial cases which are not completely trivial and not completely useless. And so here is such a special polynomial case. So you have equality. Here I write the equalities in a particular way. I write it so there are three forms of inequalities over the integers now. Inequalities. We leave the range of equalities, go to the inequalities, but again have integers. So the one thing is that you have upper and lower bounds to individual integers, and then you have two variable equalities where one occurs, if you like, one occurs positive and one occurs negative, and the coefficients are all zero or one. So here like that, x is greater or equal to y plus 5. Or here, y is greater or equal to z minus 7. X minus 7. And so now this turns out that this kind of the question is, where do such kind of problems occur? And in fact, we kind of encountered them. There are particular forms of problems which, in computer science, they occur for certain flow problems. And it might also be the case that for certain cases, like the ones which we have looked at, where one wants to determine absence of conflicts for loop fusion or so, things like that could also show up. Now, why is this case polynomial? And the reason is that you can have a nice graphical representation. So here in that case, so if you have an upper bound, so the arrow goes means that this is my convention, it is less or equal. So x is less or equal to 19. And here 13 is a lower bound to y, and that is one thing. And then you have here x is greater or equal to y plus 5, and so this gives the 5 here, and y is greater or equal to x minus 7, so this gives the minus 7 here. And by that you kind of have obtained a graphical representation of the problem, and you see that you have something like a minimal, so the lower bound, somehow minimal weight. So the if you assign a weight to the X, it should satisfy that the weight for the Y should be five less. So you could put a larger weight to the X, but you have something like a minimal weight which you could can put to the X. So in that sense, it is, if you like, a now it has kind of turned to a graph problem. Yeah? Assign numbers to these X's so that all these constraints assign numbers to the vertices of this graph so that all the constraints are satisfied. And what one also notices is that there's something like a minimal number, a minimal assignment which you could put. So for the Y, the minimal assignment would be, it must at least be 13. And then now you, and then the minimal value for the X would be 13 plus 5 is 18. And then clearly 18 is less or equal to 19, so that's fine. And then there's only one thing here, is this stupid back edge. But if that must, that Y is greater or equal than X minus 7, and this is true, because Y is 13 and X is, we made it 18. 18 minus 7 is 11, and that is less or equal to 13. Yeah, so in that sense, then all the constraints are satisfied. The only thing is what you have to make sure that if you have such a cycle, so you see now a situation where this cycle may cause problems, and that is if you do not have minus 7 here, but minus 3. That means that if you now try to assign a value to the, you start with 13 for the Y, then X should be at least 18, but then Y should be at least 18 minus 3, and 18 minus 3 is 15, so this was not good enough. You have to put 15, but then X also should be 20, and then, oh, then here you have 17, and so on. So you get you will not be able to solve to this system of set of constraints consistently. So this means, once again, this means that on all these cycles you must make sure that the sum of the weights is negative or zero. Otherwise, we would not be able to obtain a consistent solution. Yeah. So here these are the constraints what we note is the inequations are satisfiable if the weight of every cycle is at most zero. So it could be negative, but it should not be positive. And the weights of path reaching an X are bounded by the weights of the edges from X to the sink. So this is the second thing. So whatever we try, the goal was to assign minimal weights to the nodes. And if we have assigned a minimal weight to the X, then we now may check if that is less or equal to 19. If already the minimal weight to X exceeds 19, then any other weight also will exceed 19, and so we will not be able to satisfy everything. So this means we once again, so the procedure in some sense is you look at this part of the set of inequations, so you kind of for the moment ignore the upper bounds, only consider the lower bounds and the dependencies between the variables, find the least assignment to these, and then check whether the constraints for the upper bounds are satisfied. Yeah? So here in that particular case, we find that this cycle has weight, has negative weight, so it's fine, and we can obtain as we would assign 18 to X, and that is less or equal to 19, and therefore we are fine. Okay. And now how can we do, compute that? So there are one thing which one could try to do is simply to compute the reflexive and transitive closure of the edge weights. And that is something like it's Floyd Warshall. It's related to the Floyd Warshall algorithm, but you could also just compute. You do not compute the reflexive and transitive closure of the edge weights, but only try to do at least a kind of Bellman-Ford algorithm to compute the minimal weights for all the variables. I may kind of illustrate that here. So what the Bellman-Ford algorithm would do here. So the Bellman-Ford algorithm would kind of, so we have, so here I write, so what does Bellman-Ford do? So you have two variables, x and y. You start with a minus infinity for both of them, and then you try to determine, you evaluate the constraints. So the first thing is you look at the ingoing edges for the y. So y should be at least the value of x minus 7. Okay, so minus infinity minus 7 is minus infinity. But you have another ingoing edge, which is the 13, which you have to satisfy. So therefore, for the y. So, sorry. No, I should kind of go do a round robin iteration. So first, I look at the x. So there's one ingoing edge coming from the y. And this gives us, okay, so this is minus infinity plus 5 is minus infinity. And for the y, we obtain minus infinity minus 7 coming from the x, and which is minus infinity, but also it should be at least be 19. So this gives us 13. Gives us 13. Yeah, because it's the least upper bound of the contribution along one incoming edge and the other one, and this is 13. Okay? So in the next iteration, we go for the... So this was 0. This is iteration 1. Now comes iteration 2. So iteration 2 checks. So now the value for x is the value of y plus 5. So this is 18. And then the value for y does not... So it's the maximum of 18 minus 7, which is 11, and 13. So this is again 13. So nothing changes here. Now the next iteration, so what does Bellman-Ford say? Bellman-Ford algorithm says you iterate as often as you have number of variables. So here it is x and y, so it's only two variables. So that is, we have now kind of reached, we have obtained all finite values. And if in the next iteration some variable still increases, it goes to infinity. So in the next iteration, we find that x it does not increase anymore. So it's still 18, and the y also doesn't increase anymore. It's still 13. So that means we have reached the fixed point. So if there had been an increase, then there would have been a cycle with an increase, and then this means we could go to infinity. But here there was no cycle with an increase, so therefore... it stabilizes after these two iterations. So that is, we are happy to find the least values for x and y, and then we compare the value of x with the upper bound 19, and we see it's fine. So everything is fine. Okay? So in that sense, Bellman-Ford solves that kind of problem. Okay? Yeah, so I may add here or use Bellman-Ford. Okay, so that but now this was nice exercise to see that it works there, but one might wonder what is a general method, and we would like to have a general method. And then there there is an old method going back here to two guys, Mr. Fourier and Mr. Motzkin. And the method is called Fourier-Motzkin elimination. This is the Mr. Fourier. And so I like to think, so he was he must have been kind of a mathematician, but he lived during the French Revolution. And I'm not so sure, maybe he was even a politician as well. And you see that he kind of survived the French Revolution, which is a non-trivial thing. And at that time, questions about equality and inequality were a serious issue. And here he kind of he provided a method for resolving inequalities. So in that sense, it was a highly political and mathematical issue which he treated. So in that sense, at his time, it was incredibly interesting, and we still can use it. The method is not so difficult. Therefore, I explain it to you. One must say, if one only has inequalities or equalities over the rationals, then you could apply linear programming, so the simplex method and these kind of methods. But these are only from the 20th century, so simplex, I guess, was invented by some kind of economic mathematician or something in the 50s or so. I think so. I hope. Or in the 40s, but I think in the 50s. So it's not so long around. So it's less than 100 years. While this Fourier-Motzkin elimination is much older and in some sense easier to understand. So in some sense it is, it tries to mimic the way how one would solve equation systems. And in particular, the equation systems by an elimination procedure. And you can solve equation systems by you select a variable, you express this variable by all other variables, and then you kind of eliminate it from the equation system and obtain a simpler system, simpler in that sense that it contains one variable less. And that is the idea also of this Fourier-Motzkin elimination. So that is, it consists of a sequence of removals of individual variables. Now, the same variable, you cannot kind of take one equation and put and express the x by all the other variables. This is not possible because you have inequalities, but you can do the same trick as we did for the one variable case. You can use the inequalities where x occurs positive to infer lower bounds to the x, and you can take the negative the inequalities where x occurs negative to obtain upper bounds. And now the lower bounds and the upper bounds are expressed in all the other variables, and then you state that all the lower bounds must be less or equal than the upper bounds, and this gives you inequalities, many inequalities, but all inequalities with one variable less. So here is the example. And I hope I will kind of succeed to show at least a few steps. So here we have only for simplicity two of these variables x1 and x2, and this has the good effect that the result, the set of solutions, can be visualized as a convex polyhedron in the plane. Yeah. So here are all these inequalities, and now I took the the liberty to put the constants to the left, and only the variables are to the right. And now again, we might identify the positive occurrences where we obtain lower bounds. So here, the positive occurrences of the x, which is here and there and there and there, and the negative occurrences of the x1, these are these ones. There we obtain upper bounds. So therefore we have now the lower bound constraints here and the upper bound constraints there. And I have kind of divided by the coefficient of the x in order to kind of have as a kind of normalization. Yeah. And now the statement is that every such lower bound is less or equal to the corresponding to any such upper bound. And here you see the problem with the method. So it's a nice method, but you have a product to a product construction, because you have all the lower bounds are to be multiplied with all the upper bounds, and this makes it. This means in every elimination step, the number of constraints may be squared, in the worst case. So you can improve on that a little bit by starting with the elimination with the variable where there is only one positive occurrence or only one negative occurrence, because then the multiplication, and then the number of constraints would not increase. And it also turns out that this squaring, you may say, it will not happen in practice. And it is true that if you have only few variables, then this Fourier-Motzkin elimination is fine. But if you have many variables, then this Fourier-Motzkin elimination will soon explode. And then it will be arbitrarily ugly. But for a sufficiently small number of variables, it is still a decent method. Okay, so now we obtain, here I have written down all the all these quadratically many putting the lower bounds less or equal to the upper bounds. So this is now here, and you see now this is a system which is very nice, because it is with one variable only, and now we are already at the end of the recursion, because then we kind of sort combine this with that, and get we obtain then that, and I kind of normalized a little bit, and then you still could be divide by 7 or even by minus 7, and then get an upper bound for the x2, and so on for every other in equation provides us with an upper or lower bound for the x2. And then that gives us, so here is the corresponding values which we obtain, and then the one variable case, we know how to deal with it. We collect the lower bounds and take the maximum, we collect the upper bounds and take the minimum, and then we get an interval for the x2. And we have the interval for the x2, and then we can since we have the interval for the x2, we then can kind of determine the interval for the x2 can be translated back into lower bounds for the x1 and into upper bounds for the x1, and then can obtain the x1 also, and then we have solved the system. Yeah. So once again, the original system has a solution over Q, and that's now essential, over the rationals, if and only if after the elimination of one variable, the system has a solution. And so that gives us, so in that sense, we can use Fourier-Motzkin elimination, so this back substitution we even do not have to do. We just kind of do it in one direction, and if we end up in a non-empty interval, then the system has a solution over Q. And so in that sense, we have not solved the original problem. We only have solved the satisfiability of linear constraints over the rationals. But if it has no solution of the rationals, it also has no solution of the integers. So in that sense, we know there is no conflict, and we are happy. So in that sense, it's all fine, even if it does not solve the integer satisfiability problem. On the negative side, every elimination step may increase the number of constraints considerably. In the worst case, square it, and that means that the whole algorithm runs, the running time is very bad. So it could be exponential. Now the interesting point is that it has been, this Fourier-Motzkin elimination has been the starting point of a method to construct a solver for integer linear satisfiability, and this is the so-called omega test. And now that is what we would like, what I would like to try to explain to you next. I guess in these 5 minutes I will not go far with that. And this goes back to this guy here, William Pugh. He really comes from the compiler area and concurrent programming and things like that. And he was interested in solving these kind of integer linear programming problems, and he tried to implement something which works, and so he came up with this omega test and the omega library. I guess this is which is still around, and although there are integer linear programming and integer satisfiability has also more applications than just in compilers, and there other his test is not considered the most the best, but in the compiler's application it is often the method of choice. So now what is the idea I still can explain to you here. So the idea is the same as for Fourier-Motzkin elimination. One simply successively removes variables, and the only thing is we cannot do the division, so that's clear. And we can go for the Fourier-Motzkin type of elimination if all the coefficients of x in the system are plus minus one. So then we are on the safe side. Everything is fine. Now, once again, for this, you might say, so this is only the trivial case. And it is the trivial case, but if you think of if we index arrays, then do we iterate over arrays and have multiplying coefficients by 1, 2, 3? And it's not so frequent. So if you have a multidimensional array encoded into a single dimensional array, yes, then you would have really linear coefficients which are different from 1. So therefore, it is still often enough the case, but we cannot rely on it. But at least if that is the case, then if the coefficients are plus minus 1, then we can apply direct Fourier-Motzkin elimination and So everything is easy. Otherwise we could have, what could we do? So here we have this situation here. We have a lower bound for 6 x1 and an upper bound for 6 x1 and a lower bound for 4 x1. So that means we cannot kind of eliminate the intermediate x1 directly, but we could kind of go for a common multiple. So we scale again both inequalities with a factor. Now here in this case it would not be 4 and 6, but you would only take 2 and 3. So to be a little bit conservative. And or in this case one could even and the first the other thing is they kind of make these inequalities into strict inequalities. As it is over integers, you can always do it by adding one or subtracting one. So that's the first step. And then here you are, another thing which you always can do is if you have such a thing and a common multiple, then you can kind of divide by that. By that you can simplify, and in that case simplified, so you get a bit of a smaller factor here. And then you kind of can, if you then scale the first inequality with 4 and the second with 3, then you can derive this kind of inequality. Perhaps you could even do it in, so you could even consider So in that sense, it, so that one could do. One could be a little bit less restrictive in only going to a strict inequality for either the upper bounds or the lower bounds, and then do the to put them into relation and get a strict inequality back. But I guess for today, let us stop here, and then we see what we then can do with. So this is an elimination thing because we derive some kind of inequalities which follow, and if in the end we kind of arrive at something which is unsatisfiable, then clearly. The whole system is unsatisfiable. But what happens if the... So that is kind of the problem which we have to think about, and we kind of continue there next week. Thank you.